It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up this hour, we'll talk to incoming UW System President Ray Cross.
But first, we take a look at safety in the home. Whether you're an older person, a caregiver, or an adult child taking care of your parent in the home, safety matters when it comes to maintaining independence.
Our next guest is here to help, whether it comes to preventing falls, burns, or even accidental poisoning.
Dorothy Drago is with us now. She's a consumer product safety expert. She previously worked as a senior analyst for the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission. And she's the author of the book Living Safely, Aging Well, A Guide to Preventing Injuries at Home. Dottie, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you so very much.
Why do we need to be so concerned with injuries as we age?
Well, you know, as we age, we are really becoming a large part of the population. And I think the baby boomers want to maintain a nice active lifestyle. We see that being 60 or 70 today is really being a whole lot younger than people who were 60 or 70 a generation ago. Part of staying healthy is staying injury-free. So we really want that combination so that we move into our later years with the best ability to enjoy them.
What is it that happens during the aging process that makes us so much more vulnerable to things like falling or burns?
Well, a lot of changes happen just naturally as we age. Of course, I think we can all recognize that we have some decline in our vision and hearing. When those kinds of things happen, we can make mistakes in medicines that we look at. We can probably fail to notice something that we might trip over. Hearing, in fact, is something that people might not know affects your health and safety so much. But think about the things that we take for granted that we can hear that when we're younger, like alarms, smoke alarms, sirens on the road, things like that. When we start to lose our ability to hear those things, we put ourselves at greater risk. The other thing that happens, of course, that can be a factor is cognitive decline. And that can happen either, you know, as a gradual dementia that is not really acute or recognized. And when we start losing our ability to understand things that we used to very easily, it's easier to make mistakes. And so we find ourselves that this is a combination of changes that happen as a natural progression that just put us at increased risk.
For a lot of aging adults, something that's very important to them and their families is to keep that person in the home as long as possible. And that means making the environment safe. What do we need to do? What is the most important thing that people can do to make the home safe?
Well, I think one of the critical issues about staying home safely is really preventing a fall. We know that falls are really the most hazardous thing that can happen to someone in their age as they age. For one thing, if you fall once, you're much more likely to fall again. And the problem with falls is that we can break bones, break hips. They can be serious enough to make us be hospitalized. Once you're hospitalized, you can get infection. And then once you have a longer rehab to come back to living fully on your own and your own independence. And it's funny that, you know, we really need to maintain a strength about us, a real physical strength to help us not fall. And once you fall and become a little more immobile because you're healing, that ironically puts you at a greater risk because then you begin to not move as much, become more sedentary. And it's a little bit It's easy, actually, to get into this cycle of having fallen, being afraid to fall, not moving as much, and it's as if the cycle of that makes you even at a higher risk to fall. So I would say preventing a fall is the most important thing at home.
So obviously part of that, as you just hinted at, is staying active and trying to stay strong. But if you're doing those things, if you're getting your walks in, maybe you're doing some strength or weight-bearing exercises, what can you do to kind of secure your home environment and minimize the chances that you actually will fall?
Well, one of the things you can do is just take a look all around. Tripping hazards are something that you can recognize and do away with. Look, start on the floor. Look at what you've got for rugs and carpeting. We know that area rugs are a greater hazard, a tripping hazard, than wall-to-wall carpeting, for example. Now, especially if someone may be using a walker or something, or a cane, something that's on the floor like that that is not secured, like wall-to-wall carpeting is, can be a tripping hazard. The other thing you really want to look at is your stairways. Are your handles secure? Do you hold on to the handrail every time you go up and down? Look for steps that you have to go up and down, changes in elevation, thresholds. Are they well marked? If your vision is a little bit decreased, maybe you need to add some color tape or something like that to make that change in elevation more readily recognized. And in fact, changes that you can make in and around the home are really fairly easier than making changes to yourself. We know, I discuss in the book, the difference between extrinsic factors, or those outside of you, like the rugs I just mentioned, and intrinsic factors, like maybe the medication you're taking or how strong you are. And both of those are important, but it's sometimes a lot easier to look around your home, get those extension cords, for example, out of the way. It's tripping hazards. It's those kinds of things that we can change and we can readily identify.
You write about a surprising number of people who seem to get tangled up in their sheets or their comforters on the floor.
Yes, yes. It's interesting because a lot of people will use the bed to sit on, to dress. But those kinds of materials, whether it's a silky comforter or sheets, they can actually act like a slide so that you'll sit down and there's not enough friction between you and the material. And as you start dressing or lifting a leg off the bed or something like that, you can actually just slide right onto the floor. And in other cases, dangling sheets. I mean, we almost have to learn how to make a bed really, really neatly. Tuck those corners up. Get that stuff off the floor. It's partly, too, because people's gait can change as they age. And so you may shuffle a little bit and not pick your feet up. It makes it so much easier to trip onto something that's dragging along the floor. So making up the bed quickly and using the right kinds of sheets, more flannel perhaps, or something that's just not as slippery, or using a chair to sit down to dress instead of the edge of the bed.
What about burns? Why are burns an issue as we age?
Oh, yes, because the aging skin can be burned much more deeply and much more quickly than younger skin. And another thing is, as we age, we kind of lose the sensation of touch. This can also be aggravated by diseases like diabetes, for example. And so you can be in contact with something that's a hot surface longer than you would be if you were younger and had all your sensation, so that you don't sense the heat. You stay in contact longer with it, you get a deeper burn, and it takes a lot longer to heal.
And as we wrap up here, how do we know when home safety isn't enough, when it's not something that we can handle anymore and we need more help?
Mm-hmm. Well, I can actually use my mom as an example, because she was living with me as she was aging, and her dementia was really, really getting serious. And we were not able to contain her falls, and we found that that was a very serious issue for her. And my father was elderly. It came to the point where we realized we needed her to be watched and guarded more carefully. So I think cognitive issues are a big impact here. And then the strength and ability of the person. So I think you kind of weigh, and these, you know, it requires family discussions. These are delicate issues. They're not easy to talk about and not always easy to address. But I think if you really observe the person that you're concerned about, I think you'll have a sense of when you're kind of losing control to help that person. And I think then, you know, the idea is to seek out elder care facilities. There are lots of resources out there that will help you decide, you know, how you can keep someone at home longer. And if it's really not a realistic thing, then to help you place that person somewhere that's appropriate for them.
Dorothy, thank you so much for joining us and sharing what you know.
It was totally my pleasure, Veronica. Thank you.
That was Dorothy Drago. She's a consumer product safety expert, and she's the author of Living Safely, Aging Well, A Guide to Preventing Injuries at Home.
we've got incoming UW System President Ray Cross with us here in the studio. It was announced late last week that he got the job. He's set to replace outgoing President Kevin Riley, who oversaw the system for the last 9 years.
He joins the system at a time when it's facing some challenges, from the cost of tuition to a rocky relationship with the state legislature.
We'd also like to hear from you. What questions do you have for the incoming UW System President? What challenges facing the UW would you like to see him tackle? Give a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. A bit of full disclosure here. We are employees of the UW Extension, meaning Ray Cross is currently our boss and will continue to be our boss in his new position.
And with that, Ray Cross, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. I'll try to take advantage of that.
Well, here's a quote. After you got your job, you said, "When you first look at it, it seems God himself couldn't do the job, but one step at a time we'll make progress." So looking at a job that perhaps God himself couldn't do, what made you want to take this on?
I don't know. well, I mean, part of what I think is attractive is the reality that this is a great system with great and competent, talented faculty, staff. It's widely recognized as one of the best in the world, and it has incredible potential. So that's sort of like a magnetic draw. I don't know if that's fair, but for someone who looks at that and said, to get the opportunity to play a role, albeit perhaps small, and something like that is very exciting. Secondly, I had to examine whether I really had the ability to help the university, the system. In some ways, I thought, yes, I do. And I tried to weigh my strengths and weaknesses honestly. And in doing so, I said a few of these strengths I think are really going to be helpful, the ability to build relationships with the legislature, communicate, listen, can I do that? The weaknesses in an effort to be honest with myself, well, I got to make sure that these kinds of things I can deal with those well. So,
and you're not a stranger to the UW system, as we mentioned. You're the chancellor of UW Extension and UW Colleges for the last few years. At the risk of sounding like a job interview, looking back before that, what else in your background do you think is going to help you now that you're president of the or incoming president of the UW system?
Well, this is probably going to sound a little corny, but I once gave a commencement speech that was titled "Everything I Needed to Know in Life I Learned on the Farm." So as a farm boy, there are a number of wonderful things you learn that become a part of your life. One is that that you accept responsibility. And my father used to put me in charge of milking the cows at night. That was my job, and I felt an obligation. It was my responsibility. And that sense of responsibility is important in these positions. The farm certainly isn't the only place one acquires that. But building that sense of responsibility at a young age, I think, is important. And that's just one piece of those kinds of things in your background. I also have experience in the business sector, not just in higher education. And higher education is often confused in the eyes of is confusing in the eyes of the public because it's perceived as, well, why don't they operate that more like a business? Mm-hmm. There are a number of things that do operate as a business within higher education. But what goes on in the classroom is an educational process that involves the engagement of people in a dialogue and the development of character. It's far more than simply what someone writes or explains in a test.
Now, you're talking about reaching out to people, and it's interesting to hear you say that because last week that is exactly what you did. Right after you got the job, you started calling up legislators. On Friday, you were knocking on doors, introducing yourself. Why was it important to you to make that outreach right away?
In some ways, that's symbolic, but a lot of those folks are my friends. We don't have to always agree on things. In fact, my wife and I don't always agree on things, and I suspect that's true in your lives. But I have a lot of respect for many of those folks, and I enjoy them, and I appreciate their integrity and their character. And I understand they disagree in some ways about how the university should accomplish its goals, but I haven't met a one of them who doesn't want the university to be the very best.
I'd like to go to one of our callers now. We've got Chris in Wisconsin Dells on the line. Chris, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I've been waiting for this call for a long, long time. I am currently operating under a gag order from the University of Wisconsin Chief Legal Counsel at UWM that I am not allowed to tell my story to anybody involved with the university. It has not been through a court of law, even though I have gone to the Board of Regents and said, put it through a court of law, because nobody in the state of Wisconsin judiciary will ever, ever, ever upstand this. Okay, I filed a civil rights complaint against a bunch of professors at UWM that were sexual predators, and I won. I won.
Chris, I'm going to cut in. I think this is a very specific topic that Ray Cross probably hasn't come across his desk yet. He's not even at his desk yet. So I'm sorry. It sounds like a difficult situation, but I don't know that that is something we can tackle here. What I did want to get to, Ray Cross, is the issue of financial transparency, following up with you talking with legislators. This is a big controversy earlier this year. Discovery, apparently, that a lot of different parts of the UW system had a lot of reserve money. Lawmakers questioned the amounts there. How do you tackle that issue?
I think the best way to tackle that, and from my perspective, is in a totally open and honest fashion. We are a public university, and we should have people looking over our shoulders. And we should be as transparent as absolutely possible. Chris's question and comment in some ways is related. How do we behave in a responsible, open fashion and while carrying on our business? On the financial side, my goal is to simplify documents and reports so that the average person can understand them. You shouldn't have to be a CPA to understand in a broad sense our financials. And that's my goal. And having served on several boards, including corporate boards, I understand the kind of reporting documents that we got on a monthly basis that helped us understand the fiscal or financial position of the organization last month, the changes this month, the differentials. And I think those are the kinds of documents that we need for the board to say, I understand what's going on, and for legislators who aren't CPAs to understand as well. So one of my goals is to simplify the reporting structures and to streamline the budgeting process.
And are you hoping to make that transparency something that extends not just to legislators and the board, but to the general public here in Wisconsin?
Absolutely. We are ultimately accountable through those legislators to the public. They represent the public, and that's something I want to respect.
There was a rocky stretch related to that issue earlier this year. Do you think in this honeymoon stage you're in right now that you can kind of hit the reset button, to paraphrase Hillary Clinton there, and get off to a new start and avoid that rocky road?
I don't know. I believe that our critics will also be very careful, and I want them to be, and I think that's important. I simply want to engage them in an honest way, and I believe they'll respond accordingly. I also think it's important that as the university builds its next budget, that we start looking at how to collect information from the people of this state. The Wisconsin idea is often touted as the university bringing the resources of the university to the people. I believe there's a second half, the university listening to the people and bringing their problems to the university.
So you're talking about making that more of a two-way street, something that's flowing in two directions.
Yes, and it's the second direction, I think, that has value and adds value for the people of this state.
Does that represent a change, do you think, to the way the university functions right now?
I don't think it represents a change from 1930. I think it represents a change perhaps today, because we lecture well, now we need to learn to listen well.
We're talking with incoming UW System President Ray Cross right now, and we'd like to hear from you, too. What questions do you have for him, and what issues would you like to see Ray Cross take on as incoming president of the UW System? You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We've got Ray Cross with us now. He's the incoming president of the UW System. And we're taking your calls for him at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. And you can also send an email to talk@WPR.org or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll get to your calls in just a moment. But before we do, Ray, I wanted to ask you about tuition. That's an issue I'm sure you'll hear a lot of questions about in the coming months and years.
Tuition is one of those things that I'm concerned about, something that concerns me as a father of four. It's something we've had to deal with, and it seems like it is constantly going up. There are several factors contributing to that. Obviously, the reduction in state aid, I understand that. But some of the things we can do to reduce the net cost to students and their families is reduce time to graduation. The average right now within the university is about 9.5 semesters. If we can reduce that to under 9, can we say that we have cut the cost as much as 10 or 12% to families? Things of that nature, I think, need to be explored. In addition to that, Minnesota has a higher tuition and a higher aid formula, so they're considered more affordable. Can we work in those arenas as well? I'm not arguing for that model. I'm suggesting it's the net cost that is important. And there are a number of other factors. There needs to be a lot of work on federal financial aid. And, of course, one factor that we always have to work on is lowering cost internally. Can we reduce expenses? And that's something that's constantly on my mind. Can we do things, some things? I'm not talking about the classroom. I'm talking about back office stuff. Can we do those things more efficiently without losing the effectiveness?
Well, let's get our callers in on this. We have Lyman joining us now from Beloit. Hi, Lyman.
Hi, good afternoon to you and your guests. Mr. Cross, congratulations on your position.
Thanks, Lyman.
You're welcome. I'm a graduate of the UW System, did both my undergraduate work and my master's work there, and I applaud your effort to reduce tuition and kind of keep an eye on that. But my issue was more with my personal view is that people will pay for a product that they find useful to them and that is good. And in my experience at the UW, at times I felt like the instructional quality was not particularly geared towards my success. I felt like I achieved outside of the classroom and despite what was, in my opinion, sometimes horrible instructors.
All right, let's leave it there, Lyman, and try to get Ray in on this. And in an oblique way, he's addressing a bit of talent retention as well. What would you say about instructional quality at the UW system?
One of the things that I think Lyman is putting his finger on is how do we constantly monitor and improve quality? I don't know of a faculty member who doesn't want to be a better faculty member, even the great ones. And I don't know of a grad assistant who doesn't want to do an outstanding job. How do we help them by monitoring that? And how do we work to maintain our star faculty? And I use that term probably too often because we have a lot of them. What do we do? And one of those areas is compensation. And I fear that given the salaries we pay our faculty, that we need to make some adjustments there. Otherwise, we're at risk of losing those over time. Good faculty are on the market, and it could be on the market, and we have to compete for them, and that's a challenge for us. And Lyman's point about quality, I think, is something that is really important for the system to constantly monitor. Now, I would argue that it's a great quality education, and I suspect that Lyman's experience was not the norm. However, we want to make everyone's experience the highest quality educational experience possible.
Thanks for the call, Lyman. We'll go to Matt in Milwaukee now. Hi, Matt.
Hi there. My question is rooted in adjunct and sessional instructors. My brother has been a part of the UW system for well over a decade, and I, based on things that he noticed too, the UW system is increasingly getting more and more adjunct and sessional instructors, and my brother has evolved into a top quality professor. I've seen him teach. I can't say professor because it's not right, but I'm wondering what the UW system might do to help those people that have done so well in their terms and not just continue to hold people into a limited role with money and security, but Matt, to increase the ability.
Matt, thanks a lot for the call. So this has been a nationwide issue, fewer tenured full-time faculty, more part-time adjunct or sessional lecturers.
Matt's correct. He's correct in that it is a national issue, Rob. The challenges we face in trying to handle larger numbers of students is in a classroom to make a quality experience are some of those kinds of things he's pointing out. I would differ a bit, I think, with Matt. We are doing everything we can to maintain full-time faculty positions. Obviously, we're having to fill in the margins with adjuncts. So I understand that, and it's much more acute. Believe me, I came from New York, and I was in Minnesota and Michigan before that, and it is much more acute in other states. There is a real seriousness, I know, within the colleges to maintain those full faculty-appointed positions and not let that degrade below a certain percentage, which is impressive.
Well, thank you to Matt for that call, and let's go next to Bob joining us from Oconomowoc. Hi, Bob.
Good afternoon. Congratulations to Mr. Cross.
And thank you, Bob.
I know it's a difficult job, and I wish him the very best. As a product of the UW system and Madison, I just want to say that I hope that they stress the excellent research capabilities at Madison. I know that so many people and families talk about quality instruction and, you know, a lot of things about the student, but at some point, I think the student has to have a lot more responsibility. And, you know, Madison was a quality research facility, and I hope that that continues, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Bob. And Bob getting at wanting the UW system to remain strong as a research facility.
Absolutely, and Bob used the phrase, Madison was. I would like to politely correct that, Bob. It is a leading research institution. It's always in the top 4 or 5, depending on the measure, it's up in the top 4, 5, or 6 constantly. And I know that Rebecca Blank, Chancellor Blank, her commitment is to increase that. I support that entirely, both in terms of federal efforts, and I would like to see us do more corporate research. But that is the core. Basic research, whether it's in the humanities or in the sciences, is at the core of stimulating new ideas, and it works really well if you're even an undergrad participating in research programs. It has a positive impact on what you do as a student and on your life. So, yes, I'm a strong supporter of that. I agree entirely.
You've gotten a lot of attention, including in the news that came out after you got the job, for the flexible option for adult students using life experiences in part for credit. Looking ahead, do you have other innovations in mind for the UW system in a changing higher educational environment that we might look toward in the future?
Well, thanks, Rob. I think the Flex is innovative, and we're still working our way through some of those issues, but it's coming along nicely. And it's targeted toward a specific audience, primarily an adult audience. And there are other things that I hope we embrace and experiment with. I don't think I think we too often try to make sure it's going to work from day one, rather than let's try something in the higher education world, and if it doesn't work, try something else. Quickly admit failure and move on. And there are a number of things that are falling around in this rather empty head of mine. But I think that there are thousands of those ideas bouncing around in the heads of great people in this institution. And I'd like to hear theirs as well.
Well, Mr. Cross, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Veronica. Thank you.
Ray Cross is the incoming president of the UW system.
But first, we continue our Teach Me What You Know series. Last week, we learned how to ace an interview with the director of the UW's career services. This week, we'll learn how to improve our memory.
You might have heard that doing crossword puzzles or learning a new language can keep our minds sharp, but is there more to it? As cases of Alzheimer's and dementia increase nationally, the question of how to practice good brain health is making news regularly, and we'd like to get a sense of what's myth and what can actually make a difference.
Here with some tips on boosting a memory is Dr. Gayatri Devi. She is the director of New York Memory Services and associate professor of neurology and psychiatry at the NYU School of Medicine. Dr. Devi, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, to start, what can we do in terms of lifestyle that'll give our brains a little boost?
Well, several things. The most important and the easiest thing you could do to help improve your memory is to sleep. Sleeping is associated with consolidation of memory, which basically means that your memory then gets laid down within the brain so that you can access it later. And that's very much a function of sleep. And in the last several months, there have been some exciting studies where they've found that mice that sleep well have less deposits of this toxic amyloid plaque, which is associated with Alzheimer's disease. And people who sleep well also have less development of the plaques that are associated with Alzheimer's.
And I've been hearing stuff lately in Alzheimer's research saying something along the lines of, hey, that stuff you want to do for heart health, it's going to help your brain too. Is that true?
That is absolutely true. Anything that's good for your heart is going to be good for your brain, and that includes things like diet. So if you have a good Mediterranean diet, which is good for the heart, which is very high in the type of fats and the type of food that's good for the heart and good for the blood vessels, then that means there's going to be better blood flow to your brain and your brain health will also be better. Exercise, especially aerobic exercise, is good for the heart and that's also good for the brain. Low cholesterol diets are good for the heart and that's good for the brain. So yes, absolutely. Anything that's good for the heart is going to be good for your brain.
And it seems like in pop culture or just in conversation, somebody will say something about a particular food and say, oh yeah, that's a brain food. That's a good brain, like salmon, I've heard. But I like salmon, so I don't mind eating that. Is there really such a thing as a brain food?
Most antioxidant foods that are rich in antioxidants, so for example, blueberries are good for the brain. And recently, last summer, there was a wonderful study where they looked at people who drank a cup of cocoa, hot chocolate, daily for a month, and they found that their brain blood flow was improved. Now, you have to kind of balance that because you don't want to drink enough cocoa that you're putting on weight, but if a little bit of cocoa seems to be associated with better blood flow to the brain.
And that reminds me, I just saw a headline the other day, something about caffeine being good for our memory. Is that what's doing it in the cocoa? Or is it something else? And is caffeine really good for our memory?
So the caffeine, what it does is it's a little bit of a stimulant. So that's good for just all of us, you know, in terms of thinking and attention and concentration. But the trick is you don't want to have too much caffeine. What's found in cocoa is not really caffeine, but flavanol, which is an antioxidant, and that's really what's thought to be helpful in terms of the cocoa-related improvement in memory loss. But generally, you want to kind of balance, you know, everything in moderation, so not too much cocoa and not too much caffeine, because then you won't be able to sleep at night.
So that's the food, the exercise. How about can we train our brain to remember better? Can we make ourselves remember stuff?
Absolutely. I mean, there are very classic exercises that people can do to help remember. And one classic exercise is using what's called a method of loci, which is where you associate different parts of a room in your home, for example, with a list of random things, so that if you wanted to go to the drugstore and you had a list of 10 things that you needed to remember, then you associated with different items in the room, and that helps you remember better. If you wanted to remember the name of someone called William, then you see a big dollar bill on the front of their face, and the next time you see them, you'll say, "Hey, Bill." So that's called pegging. So you can use those little kind of tricks to help improve your daily memory, but that takes a lot of practice, and it takes a lot of concentration and attention as well.
I've seen things about medieval scholars and monks. I think it was called the Cathedral of Memory, where they had a whole cathedral mapped out in their head, and they kind of carved the memory they wanted to keep in a specific part of the cathedral. With enough practice, would that really work?
Absolutely, and that's really what the method of loci is about. It's about not, you know, if you don't have a cathedral, you can use a room. But basically, what you're doing there is you're creating a story, and by putting this random list of items into a story, into, say, the map of the cathedral or the map of the room, you then imbue this random list of items with some kind of structure. So by making a story of it, you then are able to better remember. So that's very important. To make sense of something makes it easier to remember it. Other things that are important for memory is context, so context-specific memory. So if you saw someone in the supermarket and it's the person who's the checkout girl, but you see them outside the supermarket, you know you've seen them, but you don't remember their name. If you saw them at the checkout counter, you'd know their name. The other important thing is emotion. You know, the more emotion you attach to something, so very few people will forget their first kiss, for example, or if they got into a fight with someone, they'll usually remember that better than if they didn't, because emotion helps to brand and sear that memory into parts of your brain.
So if we're taking a class, does it help us to try to have some sort of emotional feeling while we're learning as opposed to just sitting there with a glazed expression?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think that it's always good to be motivated, and you know, and that's been a proven aid for memory, a concentration. And if you imbue the class with emotion, if you are enthusiastic about the class and you make it positive so that it's an experience where you're enjoying being with your other classmates, et cetera, then that's going to help you remember better. Also, interestingly, if you were to take the exam in the same class, in the same classroom where you had learned, then that will help you remember better and retrieve better.
So there are a lot of things out there that people say improve our memory in the puzzles and games category, crossword puzzles or Sudoku, or the websites like Lumosity that are advertised as improving brain health. Do these really work?
So I have kind of a complicated response to that, which is that the most important thing you can do for your brain health and the most important thing you can do for your memory is to diversify your brain's abilities. So if you're someone who spends most of your day fact-checking or you're an editor, then you're not the kind of person who's going to benefit from doing the crossword puzzle or doing Sudoku. You'd be someone who'd be better off learning how to play the guitar or going out and chopping wood. If you're somebody who, you know, works as a housekeeper for a living and you maybe do more manual tasks during the day, then that you would be a person perhaps then who would benefit from doing Sudoku and more verbal language tasks, etc. So you want to basically involve all parts of your brain, because memory is not just in any one area. It's spread in all sections of your brain. It's a big web that your memory weaves within the fabric of your brain.
Well, that's amazing that doing different stuff, even things like chopping wood, you mentioned that I would not associate with my brain all that much. I know you have to think about it when you're doing it, but that doing those different things really boosts our memory?
Yes, because basically your memory is the ultimate result of a healthy brain. So in order to improve your brain health, you want to keep all areas of your brain very healthy. And that means, you know, lifestyle changes. It means changes in your diet. It means keeping different parts of your brain involved. So it's similar to if you want to be a good athlete, you don't want to just increase the strength in your biceps, you know, to help lift weights. You want to keep all of your body very healthy. And the same goes with the brain as well.
So I've got to ask, I remember some things incredibly well, usually worthless information, a quote from a Simpsons episode from 30 years ago or however long it's been on. And I forget things like people's names when I run into them for the 20th time. Should I feel dumb when I can't remember stuff, or am I expecting too much of my memory?
That's a great question, and the answer is absolutely yes. When you think that you're going to have, when you expect that you are going to remember the names of all the people you meet on a daily basis, I believe you're asking too much of your memory. If you just think back to 100 years ago, most of us came in contact with about 300, 400 people maximum within our lifetime, because we grew up in villages and small towns, people that we've known all of our lives. Now, in a city, even a medium-sized city, you would meet 200 to 300 people a day. And within a period of a month, you may meet 300 people whose names you're required to remember. So trying to remember and feeling bad because you don't remember the names of people when you meet so many every day, I think that's being not very kind to yourself and imposing unnecessary stress on yourself because you think, oh my goodness, I'm forgetting so much. Because forgetting, and this is very important to remember, is also an important part of our brain's functioning. Our brain needs to forget in order to remember the things it needs to remember. And maybe remembering 500 names that you, of people you met at a conference today is not important for your brain's ability to function.
In our last 30 seconds or so, how do I get my brain to prioritize? Dump the right stuff, keep the stuff I need.
Absolutely. I think sleep is important, exercise is important, diversifying your brain's ability to function in different areas is important, and stop stressing that you're not remembering.
I will really try to do that. Dr. Debbie, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Dr. Gayatri Debbie. She's director of New York Memory Services. She joined us for this installment of Teach Me What You Know. Hey, speaking of caffeine, next week we're going to learn how to brew the perfect cup of coffee from a coffee expert at the Wisconsin-based coffeehouse, Collectivo.